Hello, everyone, and welcome to, or welcome back to, and we'd like you guys more, Animoca Brands' Open Metaverse podcast. The podcast series that we're trying to, the ethos we're trying to capture here is really gathering insight from all of these founders, whether they be up and coming, already established, whether they're facing some difficulties, whatever it might be, to try to get a little bit more insight as to what Web3 is building, who is building it, and how they are building it. I usually like to start these podcasts off with a fun fact about myself. And today's fun fact is not so fun. It is a fact, though. And I'm going to be a little bit vulnerable because we've done 6 episodes now. I feel like I can't be. I was recently diagnosed with financial PTSD. Because apparently watching my portfolio repeatedly die over and over again is not necessarily mentally healthy. Thanks, Ed. So, because you've had such a distinguished career, you have flown high and you have really, honestly, a breadth and a depth of knowledge from some from really, really structured regulatory, foreign policy, all kinds of policy actually, environments and the intersection of technology between them versus the absolute cowboy Wild West. I wanted to, but successful across all, I wanted to kind of humanize you a little bit. I was going to say for
Good
the,
luck.
I know, I was going to say for the audience, but really it's for me sitting across from you. Right, so I wanted to ask you a question. What is something in your life that is not work related that you're struggling with? That you're not happy with, and you're struggling to actually improve.
I think currently it's getting exercise, getting out and about. It's easy to be at the screen, working, trying to understand the world all the time, and just getting out into the world.
And usually using that avenue as an excuse as to why you shouldn't go out into the world,
It's
please.
easy to make the excuses,
It is, it's too easy.
yeah.
Yeah. Could you please paint us a picture as to your career? Your past experiences and how they brought you here.
Sure. Okay. I mean, I've gone through a bunch of things in my career, and in hindsight, it seems like every 7 years or so, I change to something different. That's been pretty consistent. Earlier in my career, I was studying science and technology, became an academic, I started teaching at Princeton University in computer science, doing sort of core computer science operating systems kind of stuff. One day, a couple of grad students walked into my office and said, "Hey, we're working on this security project. Do you have a week or so to work on this?" And I said, "Yeah, okay, I can do that. You don't have anybody else, I'll help you out." And so that led to me switching my field into cybersecurity. I did that for a while. Then I got interested in law and policy and how it interacts with technology, and started studying that, learning, meeting people, and that led kind of to a career swerve to work on technology policy.
Interesting.
From there, but during all this time, I'd been doing research and sort of going down the academic track, which on the one hand is sort of structured teaching, doing research. On the other hand, at least as a computer science academic, you have to be pretty entrepreneurial. And later, when I became a founder, I realized that a lot of what I had done as an academic actually applied. You're recruiting talented technical people, you're raising money, you're managing budgets, you're trying to deliver things on time, trying to produce products, although those products are papers and specs and talks and so on.
They're literally called grants, ecosystem grants, et cetera.
So I went through all of this. I then swerve again and got a position in the US government at the Federal Trade Commission, which is the main privacy regulator in the US, as their first chief technologists, sort of as a policy advisor. Got to see how policy works, how regulation works from the inside. It's interesting to have had that perspective as a crypto founder, having sat on the other side of that regulator's table. And I think that has been really, really valuable. So I did that for a while. Then a couple of years, went back to Princeton, became an academic again, started working on blockchain research. So it kind of checked all, that was the next swerve. kind of checked all the boxes of things I was interested in. It was involved with security and privacy. It touched economic policy questions in a big way, interaction with government, a lot of work related to communities and so on. So I started looking at that first from a technical and economic standpoint. Then I learned about smart contracts. Nice. Got really excited because I recognized what had happened with the internet and the web earlier.
Yeah.
And that sort of Cambrian explosion was going to happen again when programmability came to the blockchain. But the big problem there was, how is this going to scale up, right? If something like Ethereum was going to be this shared world computer, that shared world computer was going to be like a tenth of a laptop of capacity.
Yeah, I know.
Right? That wasn't going to cut it. You can't share that across the whole world. So how do you scale that? So this was like 2014. And that was when the idea for Arbitrum was born, and worked with a group of students to build the very first version of it as a class project.
Yeah.
Then another swerve, I got invited to work at the White House and joined the White House staff. And so then I spent 2 years, the last 2 years of the Obama administration, as the Deputy Chief Technology Officer of the United States, working on all kinds of policy types of different policy issues and working with senior policymakers. A different view of that process. What is it like to see what happens at the White House, what happens in the Situation Room, and all of that. So that was a very intense time, much more intense than any other job I've had. So in January of 2017, it was the end of President Obama's second term. We knew that the time there was going to end. And it did. And I went back to Princeton and was decompressing.
I can imagine you needed to.
Yes. It took some time. I was wondering what I was going to do. Yeah. And then one day, two graduate students walked into my office and said, hey, let's do this Arbitrum thing again.
Wow. Nice.
So I'm decompressing. What am I going to do? Wow. And then, just like echoes of before, two graduate students, two PhD students, walk into my office and say, hey, remember that Arbitrum thing you were doing before you left? Why don't we work on that again?
Yeah.
So we started to do that. We spent about a year building this as an academic project and prototype. Kind of, we went maybe, I don't know, 30% of the way from raw idea to commercially viable product. Published an academic paper. And at that point, we said, okay, this is this feels like a startup. Let's start a company, right?
Yeah.
And so we did. We were three people in the room. We had a massive corporate treasury of $10,000. We had nothing like a product. We had no idea what we were doing. And so, you know, then a bunch of things happened. 3 years later, we had a product and we released a mainnet and it started to grow.
Yeah.
Right. And now it's become a much bigger thing. A lot more users, a lot more complex. The company is around 125 people. Many
it's
lessons learned along
lean,
the way.
Actually.
It is lean and feels like, and I like that.
Yeah.
Small teams can do more, can move faster, more coherent. Right? But nonetheless, it is growing and it's a very different experience. So we've been through that journey, which has been kind of exciting.
I mean, it sounds like your whole life has been kind of exciting.
It's one thing after another.
Yeah, yeah. And what you're calling swerves, I mean, others would call lifetime milestones. Every swerve is a lifetime milestone. But
it didn't seem like it at the time.
Yeah, I'm sure, especially because of like how compressed you were. And the different environments that you were putting yourself in, right? I mean, that you were putting.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like taking a leap each time.
Which
right.
is fantastic.
Not knowing.
You always want to be. What you said at the beginning is held true. You really do have to have an entrepreneurial mindset to be able to actually take these leaps, take these jumps, absorb what you can, and then apply them to the next thing, right?
Yeah.
Not that you were necessarily trying to do that, but.
Well, no. I mean, I can make it sound like a coherent story in hindsight, but along the way, it seemed like at every moment, I sort of had my head in a swivel. What should I be doing next?
That's good to know, because. A lot of people like from down here looking up towards you, it just seems like you're the kind of person that just has it always figured out. Everything is there. Of course you're going to build Arbitrum. Of course you're going to successfully commercialize it. But I'm sure it didn't feel like that at many points in time. Yeah, I'm sure maybe sometimes it still doesn't feel like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it always feels like there's something new happening. There's a new challenge.
Yeah,
and
there are new entrants.
I mean, it's important to do that, but also, I mean, it's kind of, I think, hard in hindsight to tell how much of a role luck has played. Luck has played a big role, there's no doubt.
Yeah, but you can't be lucky every single time, right? Well, there is skill, there is luck, there is timing.
Yeah, and I really feel like by having so much variety and doing different things and changing, that there's a sort of perspective that I've gotten. Again, sort of in hindsight, it's kind of remarkable how often I learned something because it was interesting, and then it turned out to be really useful later.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and one thing that was unusual about me as a startup founder was my age. Right. Yeah. We started this company. I was 55 at the time.
Yeah.
There's not that many 55-year-old first-time founders.
Yeah.
But that, again, has proven to be useful to have had more life experience.
Yeah. There are not right? so many people.
I mean, because the startup experience is an emotional roller coaster. Right. And some days you're on top of the world and everything's going amazing. The next day it's terrible. And how can you possibly succeed?
Yeah.
And I think it helped to have had more life experience, because no matter how good it was, it wasn't the best day of my life. No matter how bad it wasn't the worst day of my life.
Fair enough. That's super useful too. Your ability to preempt all of my questions is fantastic. Really. Okay. Because these are a lot of things that I kind of wanted to understand, right? Like, exactly like you say, were there good days? Were there bad days? Are there good days?
Oh,
are there bad days?
Yeah.
Of course, I'm sure there are. And I myself have not embarked on a founder's journey, but I can imagine it's incredibly stressful, right?
Yes.
But referencing back to the point you said was the most stressful in your career.
Yes.
Your time at the White House.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering a couple of different things. A, why, obviously.
Yeah.
It was the most stressful period of your life. And B, was it a crucible? I.e., did a diamond come out of that?
I hope so. I mean, I really cherish the experience. I would absolutely do it again if I could. It was at the time super intense. And for a bunch of reasons. One is you work as hard as you can in a job like that. There's a real sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
And although I was not a decision maker, I was advising decision makers on the decisions that are made are literally life and death for other people. Right. So the stakes are different and you feel those stakes in an interesting way. So I had a colleague there, for example, who worked on improving the kidney transplant system in the United States. And, you know, she could quote the facts and figures about how many people died every day, every week, because the kidney transplant system had not been improved enough.
Did you invite her to many parties or?
She was an interesting and fun person, but she also, you had this sense that there was a clock ticking in her mind, right? If I go to the movies tonight, right? That's 3 hours I don't spend solving this problem, right? And that's like 3/10 of a death.
I suppose those are the kinds of people you want, right?
You do, right. But like, how do you ever sleep? Yeah. How do you ever do anything but work when you feel that? I mean, it wasn't that direct for me, but there is a real sense of responsibility in the job.
I can't imagine.
You know, and you're doing planning for a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Also, the pace is very fast, and you constantly are giving advice, and decision makers are making decisions based on incomplete information. You really have to get comfortable with decisions being made on incomplete information, on we did our best to get the best information, but now you have to decide and move forward. Very useful from a startup founder, but this completely recalibrated my sense of what stress is, what's a difficult decision.
Fair point. So basically what you're saying is Arbitrum was a walk in the park.
By comparison, yes.
By comparison, exactly. Just the emotional wave that bears on you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Fair enough. That's incredibly interesting. So we did dive in a bit into your White House experience.
Yeah.
Oh, I did have a question about the White House, actually.
Yeah.
Is Obama really like that cool and that calm and collected the entire time, or does he have his moments?
I'm sure he has his moments.
No, it's just not in front of anyone.
Behind the scenes, yeah, he seems kind of like the person you see in public. I mean, interesting. You don't even, I mean, I did see him in unguarded moments, certainly saw him not in public. And I mean, it's one of the interesting lessons that, you know, I should have known, should have understood before going there, is all of these people, these, you know, famous people, political leaders, they're all, you know, they're just like us in many ways. You know, I remember being in a Situation Room meeting and the Attorney General was there and she was like very intense on some issue. You know, fighting for her view and arguing and not, you know, definitely in control, but very sort of vigorously advocating. And then the meeting ends and she's like,
hey,
so friendly. And she's showing people pictures of her grandkids.
Oh,
and,
that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the same thing. And I saw President Obama in some of those moments. Saw him when he said something interesting about this, actually, which is that his favorite thing was to meet with young children because they didn't know he was president. And they just treat him like a person.
Yeah, true, actually. Ubiquitous fame.
Because you can't, you know, no matter how hard you try, you can't forget that this is the president.
You cannot. No, and then if you ever do forget, he has a Secret Service detail following.
Wow, yeah. I mean, just to like treat him like, you know, I wouldn't have imagined calling him by his first name, for example. He was always, he's always Mr. President.
Yeah, yeah. What are two or three things that people might not necessarily know about it or be surprised by?
One is how small it is.
Ooh.
The West Wing especially, this is sort of the center of power. It's very small.
Where'd they film the show then? I'm just kidding.
I mean, the show looks like the real West Wing, but the thing you don't see is that the big shots, like the president, the chief of staff, the vice president, they have nice big offices.
Yeah.
Most people's offices are basically closets.
Oh, no.
If they have them, very small. So it's much smaller than you would expect. I think that's number one. Maybe number two is a bit of history. In, I think it was 1814, the White House was burned down by British troops. And there are places, and then rebuilt, and there are places on the building where you can still see the scorch marks from the fire.
Wow, that's amazing.
If you know where to look. Another one is there's a bowling alley in the basement.
No way.
There is.
Popcorn?
Well, if you weren't there,
way.
You can reserve the bowling alley. And you can bring in friends and you can bring in food and have a little party in there.
That sounds amazing.
No alcohol, but, or don't get caught.
Yeah.
But
see.
No, it's quite fun.
That's awesome.
And then finally,
you
can, if you know someone who works there, you can get a behind the scenes tour in the evening.
No way.
Yeah.
What if you know someone who worked there?
That doesn't help. So, I used to love to give those tours, though.
I can imagine. What is a behind-the-scenes tour comprise of?
I mean, what it means is you're going through the West Wing. You get to look into the Oval Office and get some of the lore about it. You really come in. And for me, I love giving the tours, partly because I'm sort of really into history.
Yeah.
And the history there is amazing. But also because it reminded me of how amazing it was to be there. Because you can get kind of jaded.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. You get, there's tunnel vision and then you just have to yank yourself out of it and show people like,
it's like, oh man, I have to go all the way over to the Situation Room for a meeting again.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, true. There are shows made about that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is kind of a gift to be reminded of how special it is to be there.
And being around such strong leaders, do you think that's influenced your leadership style?
I hope so. I mean, I saw some really great leaders in that role.
Leader of the world, this is a pretty good one.
Yeah, I mean, also people who were really, really skilled and thoughtful at motivating people. One of the things about the White House is that it can easily become a very difficult workplace because of the stress, the long hours, the uncertainty, because of the egos often that are there. The office politics there are played at an extremely high level. Everything else seems easy mode by comparison.
It's literally
the
highest level of politics.
And so it can be an inhumane place to work unless the leaders are really working to try to keep everyone working at a high level, working hard, but also be, but also feel like they're appreciated and make it a place where you feel somewhat at home. And I think seeing people who are great at that, doing that, has kind of inspired me, and I hope I've picked up some of their tricks.
Fantastic. I'm going to kind of, well, not veer, this flows very nicely into a little bit of a harder question maybe that I have, which is, it's nice to hear you say that, yeah, that motivation, that just get up and go and bring people with you is something that you at least notice it, and which means you have absorbed it, right? I suppose when new entrants come into the market, like the Ethereum war, basically, right? And in some time, and sometimes Arbitrum sees itself not hemorrhaging, but basis stealing, optimism is stealing, etc. How do you then push forward with your team? How do you strategize? What can we expect really from Arbitrum in the future?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a few things.
Yeah.
One is, that there will be ups and downs, right? And to not get too low or too high emotionally, especially to stay focused on what is the core direction you want to be moving. What are you trying to achieve? And to still always think strategically and not get caught up in the momentary narrative. How to participate in the crypto narrative is for me challenging because on the one hand, it can be contentious, it can be very short term, and it can get kind of brutal at times. And we want to advocate for our points because we believe strongly in them. I think that can be a challenging thing. I think having been around people who are really good at political messaging, maybe some of that has rubbed off.
I think you're more dangerous than you're letting on.
Maybe, I don't know.
You don't seem it.
I won't admit to that. Anyway, I mean, I think really staying focused on what you're trying to do, and especially to try to take the long view, focus on fundamentals, has been really important for us.
Fair point. I suppose it really helps when you have a lean team. That lean team generally ends up, if you're taking care of them, which you clearly are,
which you try to do,
ends up being very loyal to you, and like you say, much more easily focused on the direction, the cause, not the immediacy of the market, because really, as a founder, if you were to focus on the immediacy, as you say, of the crypto market, I mean, you're pivoting your business every 2 weeks, right? It's untenable.
You can't really do.
I mean, no, some people try, but you cannot, right? It's pivoting at the right time.
Yeah.
And pivoting when the moment is right, right?
Yeah.
So then how you guys, Arbitrum as a whole, and even off-chain, right? How are you guys viewing it, right? What's the strategy, essentially?
Yeah.
Where are you going?
I mean, I can answer that question more easily for Off-Chain Labs than for the Arbitrum community broadly.
Yeah, it's
growing. Really interesting things I think about Arbitrum and how the Arbitrum DAO operates is that it is really more decentralized, really is more democratic than I think many other projects, communities, or DAOs are.
Yeah, DAO being decentralized autonomous organization, which is a distributed decentralized governance infrastructure.
Yes. So this is the way that the Arbitrum community governs the operation of the Arbitrum one chain.
Sorry, this is just for some folks that might not.
And we took, when we decided to create the DAO and hand over the governance of the Arbitrum One chain, the main chain, to the DAO, we really did that.
Yeah.
So nothing can happen there without the DAO
voting,
the token holders voting.
Yeah.
Upgrades and decisions about technology, decisions about the community's treasury and what happens with that, all kinds of policies on the chain. Those are all decided by the community, really. It's not just their votes are not advisory to us in any way. When they vote to make something happen, it happens directly and their voting actuates it immediately on the chain.
Yeah.
That's kind of unique.
It's very unique.
And that means we have a public and there is a politics there, not in the partisan sense, but in the sense of people talking to each other and eventually voting to decide what's going to happen. Right. And that can be a chaotic and noisy process.
Yeah.
But
I mean, as
we believed in it.
Democracies are, right?
That's right. That's inherent. And this is, again, where having had some experience in the White House was valuable.
Yeah. Fair.
Seeing how people there think about interacting with the public.
Yeah.
And they will decide what they decide.
Yeah.
It really does belong to them.
Yeah. You know what they say, the worst part of everyone having a voice is everyone has a voice.
You hear a lot of voices, yeah. I mean, as far as off-chain labs, you know, we really focus on being a core technology developer.
Yeah.
We focus on supporting the broader Arbitrum community. That's not only the DAO governed chains. It's also all of the app chains or corporate chains. Yeah. There's now around 150 of them.
Yeah.
And each one has its own governance. Sometimes it's a company, sometimes it's an organization. And, you know, the Arbitrum mantra is your chain, your rules.
Yeah.
So they want different things. They want customizations. And we focus on supporting that broader community with technology development and trying to provide the missing pieces.
Yeah, there's a security base around that too, et cetera.
Sure. We focus on fundamentals, security, and then driving the core metrics. Yeah. That's lower cost, faster response time, more capacity on the chain, and better user experience.
Yeah. Having been the foundational contributors, essentially, to the creators of Arbitrum, is it not like handing your child over to a group of strangers?
Maybe not so much to a group of strangers. It feels more to me like the child growing up.
Fair enough, yeah.
And I've done that, right?
Sure. You go make your own decisions.
Yeah. And it is both scary, but also amazing when they're self-sufficient and make good decisions.
Yeah. And like a parent, you're there, you're saying, here, we're still here to support you. We're still building out technology.
We'll help you. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right, you have a problem, we'll come. But, you know, your decisions, and that's how it should be, right?
It is. It's not how it usually is from time to time.
Right.
There is a lot of emotional attachment. There's a ton of different things. Maybe DAOs don't function the way they should, et cetera.
We felt from the beginning this was the plan.
Yeah.
Right? We hoped to get to the point, to the size of community and level of success, where there would be a community to hand this to.
Yeah. Well, you're preempting my questions. I love it.
And that happened, right? And so it kind of was always the plan. But it's one thing to say we want to do this. It's another thing to figure out how.
Yeah.
And that took a long time to figure out.
Yeah. Right. So then when you're thinking about Arbitrum and its place, I mean, for those who are not aware, I actually let you give the elevator pitch as to what Arbitrum actually is fundamentally. We think we alluded to it a little bit further back, where we say it's Ethereum based and it's trying to scale on top of Ethereum because by design, Ethereum has a limited amount of, I just gave the elevator pitch. please go ahead.
I mean, this was a value proposition early on. It's built on top of Ethereum. It works just like Ethereum, but it's much cheaper, much faster.
Yeah.
And you can have many of them, right? You can have many chains that can operate side by side. It gets its core security from Ethereum, which means it uses a little slice of Ethereum service. For a while, Arbitrum One chain was the largest user of Ethereum gas, the largest single user. I don't think that's the case anymore, but it's still one of the top ones. So uses Ethereum, built on it, and very much part of the Ethereum ecosystem and the Ethereum stack. And we like to think sort of across these layers, right? Arbitrum is a layer two chain, meaning that its security is built on the foundation of Ethereum. And our team at Offchain Labs, we also make Prism, which is the largest consensus client, the largest sort of Ethereum node client. We think that's important as well, both to contribute to the success of Ethereum, but also the ability to think about the different parts of the ecosystem all through the stack and what can each layer do to help the other layers succeed.
Very, very clearly, right? And by client, consensus client, you're referring to operating a node, validating the transactions.
If you're running an Ethereum node, validating Ethereum transactions, there's a pretty good chance that you're using the Prism software.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of the biggest trends in Ethereum in the past years has been the rise of layer twos.
Yeah.
Arbitrum is a big part of that.
Yeah.
And you know, Vitalik sort of famously, at least famously to Ethereum nerds, wrote this post back in 2020 about a roll-up-centric roadmap. And this is the idea that Ethereum could scale by having these layer two systems that were built on top and they would be built independently, right? And now I think there's this moment where people are saying, was that the right strategy?
Yeah.
Right? And some people say no. I'm very strongly in the yes camp.
You guys bridge. You have all of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, partly because You know, that's the business we're in.
Yeah.
But partly, I think it is the right strategy for Ethereum. And the more I think about this, the more I go back to the analogy of the internet.
Yeah.
Right? The internet is, by a huge factor, the most successful, credibly neutral, interoperable technology platform that's ever been built.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? That we lived through that.
And there are so many lessons to learn. The internet architecture that we have beat out its competitors by being layered,
yeah,
right? Sure. And the strategy of having each layer focus on doing one thing well, and you have this stack of layers, and near the bottom, you have layers that are stable and secure and reliable.
Yeah. Built by solid professionals
who yeah.
focus on
And as you
layer.
Go up the stack, you get to layers that push the limits more. You have more diversity and variety in these higher layers. Things move faster and there's more innovation. And that's been super successful for the internet. That's why the internet has succeeded,
yeah.
really, I think. And I think it was wise for Ethereum to try to go down that same path.
Nice.
I think it's been hugely successful, right? If not for layer twos, yeah. layer twos have scaled Ethereum successfully.
Yes.
Depending which day you measure. Layer twos handle about 50 times the traffic that layer one Ethereum does.
I mean, more and more entrants come into the market too, yeah, right? Which means right. you're in the right business.
Right. And it is competitive at layer two, and that provides benefits. We can't get lazy. We can't raise our fees or anything like that. So I think it's been very successful.
Yeah.
But there is a trade-off that Ethereum has had to make, as any chain has to make. And that's the question of, are you optimizing for revenue,
yeah.
fee revenue, or are you optimizing for growth,
yeah.
right? Do you want to have high revenue or do you want to have high participation?
Yeah, and in Ethereum's yeah. cases,
and you can't have both.
No. Do you want to be a core foundational yeah. pillar of the crypto yeah. economy, or are you a business?
Are you a business that's focused on the short to medium term?
Yeah, fair.
Right? Because if you want to maximize revenue,
yeah.
you should make block space rare,
yeah.
should have less of it.
Sure.
If you want to have growth, if you want to have participation in the long term, you want to create the most value, you should want to have as much of the resources as you can possibly provide. And that means because of the way because the price of block space is driven by supply and demand,
yeah.
you increase the supply, you bring in tons more users. That's how you get that next billion users.
Sure.
But it means that the price of block space will be low.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a decision. And in a way, it's a decision that every startup, every tech company faces. Are you pricing for revenue or are you pricing for growth?
Yeah.
And Ethereum has been effectively pricing for growth and it's been working. But now there are people there who say, no, we should be pricing for revenue. To me, that's what really is at the core of the current sort of Ethereum debate.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super, super useful to understand.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm a big believer in layer twos, in the growth and having many of the chains.
Yeah.
But that does bring some challenges. And one of the biggest challenges is, how can we provide a smooth user experience in a world where there are 150 chains?
Yeah.
And they all work kind of the same, but they're all a little bit different. And users don't want to think about 150 chains.
Yeah.
They don't want to have to click five times to move assets from one chain to another, to switch chains and so on. How do we provide a smooth user experience? In a way that's compatible with user choice, compatible with security.
Options, even.
Right. And again, I go back to the internet as the analogy. Well, on the internet, there are many different services, many different sites. You know which one you're using.
Yeah.
Right? It's not all abstracted away
yeah.
To a single thing that, you know, looks like sort of a giant version of, I don't know, like 1990 version CompuServe or something,
yeah.
right? Where everything is sort of smoothed down to the lowest common denominator. You know what you're using. You can switch to something more innovative, but also you can move smoothly. The things work together.
Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest challenges we face as a broader Ethereum community
yeah.
is, how can we provide a much better user experience, right? Because so far this is, we sort of built for ourselves, which is what everyone does.
Yeah, but I mean, they came. Build it and they will come. They did.
Many of them have come,
yes.
but there are many more who have not and will not until it is much easier to use.
UI, yeah.
Right. So focusing on that UX in a realistic way, right, and that means not only sort of having smooth widgets that look good on a mobile phone and yeah. all of this, but it also means it has to permeate the whole stack.
Yeah, you see, I actually even like to the yeah. micro level of your portal, for example, at Arbitrum, yeah. it seems that you guys are really thinking about this UI UX experience.
Thinking about it, improving it.
Exactly.
We have some distance to go, well, but I mean,
you're always gonna it's a journey. UI UX, right?
But really focusing on it. But the thing that comes back, that we keep coming back to, is that you can think, what should the user experience be? But if you really want to provide it, you have to think throughout the whole stack.
Yeah.
There are things you need to do in the core protocol that provide the affordances and the hooks that allow the user interface to be what it's going
to
be.
Yeah, there are proposals that you need to submit to the DAO, basically.
Big focus there. I think a big focus, some deep thinking, some practical engineering thinking. And also, you know, since I lead the research team at Offchain Labs, thinking about what we can do at very fundamental levels to provide these things. And the idea is you should be able to have a unified user experience across chains, that it should be fast, it should be fully trustless.
Yeah.
And if you want to do stuff across chains, it should be fast.
Seamless.
Basically. As seamless as you can make it.
Basically, right?
Right? Not, boundaries are not invisible,
yeah.
but you can easily move across them.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be a bit worrying if boundaries were invisible, because you have to know that you're bridging from here to here.
You have to know where...
Yeah.
Where your money is, you have to yeah. know who you're trusting.
Exactly.
You have to know which technology, which governance.
Yeah. Which right. people, is it yeah. centralized, is it not?
Right, and the core benefit of blockchain technology is in the transparency that it provides for users, right? And if you were to throw that away in the name of user experience, well, I mean, you're back to a more centralized type of experience.
Absolutely.
So we're building, you know, we're creating something new here. That's what makes it fun.
Always.
But I think that, to me, the biggest journey that we're going to go on over the next, I don't know, months to years, is going to be about improving that user experience and about thinking more comprehensively through the whole stack.
And I love how, this is very, very commonplace when I invite founders on. It's exactly tantamount to our own thinking in Animoca Brands. You're speaking about the Ethereum community.
Yes.
Right. So like you're literally thinking about how you as a community, which is this yeah. is everybody in Web3, who has stood the test of time, at least from my humble knowledge. Those are the people that are bringing people, pulling people yeah. up with them. Right.
And I think that's,
you have to do, but yeah. Not many people, not everyone does it. Right. They fall like dominoes.
It can be difficult. For one thing, you have to provide value
yeah.
to bring people in. You also have to take the community seriously, right? If it's just lip service,
yeah.
And you know, we saw this in Web2 in a big way, right? A lot of companies was are coming up. It's all about community. We're just here for you.
Yeah.
But you know, when push comes to shove, the decisions are made centrally.
Yeah, I don't think you need
the community is a resource.
Yeah.
Right, to be exploited.
Exactly.
Right, and you know, we need to do better than that. Not yeah. just rerun that same playbook.
For sure.
And we could, you know, and we have some tools in the Web3 space that we didn't, than Web2 didn't have.
Yeah.
For one thing, we've learned lessons from what happened there.
Yeah.
For another thing, because of the way blockchain technology works, we have some ability to tie our own hands
yeah.
and to take away our own ability to just seize the controls and do yeah. what we want with it.
Absolutely. Like right. you're basically building into using the community is still a resource. But it's not a resource to build.
Only a resource.
Meaning it is a resource in the opposite sense, right?
Yes.
It's resourceful.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. And the diversity of views and experiences there becomes an asset.
Exactly.
And that's if you allow it to.
Over. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And when we hand it over control of Arbitrum One to the DAO,
yeah.
we really did that. There's no taking it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a huge leap, but we believe strongly that it was what we should do. Then in Ethereum, it's a broader community, right? And being a part of that in a constructive way is really important.
You're one of the OGs, your godfathers, basically, of the Ethereum community.
I mean, I think there's a lot of people who contribute there in a lot of different ways. Yeah, yeah.
If I would put that on your CV, honestly.
But trying to be a constructive contributor there and to bring the knowledge and experience that I do have, I think is an important part of what I'm trying to do.
Obviously proven to be very, very valuable so far. So please don't stop because who knows what's going to happen if you do. Last question is Donald Trump's tariffs.
Well, we can see what they're doing in the markets.
Yeah,
absolutely. And there's huge uncertainty, right? It's not only that the tariffs are huge, they're having an impact on the market, but there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen next. Yeah. And markets hate uncertainty. Businesses hate uncertainty. Yeah,
they always price it in to the nth degree, basically. It becomes more volatile. Yeah. You definitely put your political shoes on there. I put it to the test. I like that. Mm-hmm. But it's true. It's pretty factual, pretty objective. I mean, and the counter tariffs and everything, right?
It is true. Yeah, we don't know what the response is going to be. It's not entirely clear what his strategy is, what he plans to do to follow up, right? We hear that China is likely to increase tariffs on the U.S. in response. I think that's kind of predictable.
Yeah.
But what Trump will do next, Canada did, yes.
I'm Canadian.
It's really about the uncertainty more than anything else right now.
Generally, it's really why risk on assets like crypto are always so volatile, right? It's always the uncertainty.
Yeah. I mean, there was this, as we can see now, misconception that crypto assets are decoupled from the rest of the markets.
There's a massive misconception, actually.
Yes.
For a little bit of time there, it was kind of.
It sort of was, kind of. But I think that as we become more a part of the broader world, as there's more integration of the crypto economy with the broader finance, crypto assets more and more will move with the rest of the market.
Exactly. With ETFs coming in, with more and more purchase from the institutional side of things, it's only going to get, it's going to trade institutionally.
And we had, like it or not, a natural experiment to find out.
Yes, we did. Yes, please. I already have PTSD.
Sorry about that.
But yes, thank you so much for being here. And that's a wrap, folks.